Democracy relies on facts, accurately reported and commonly understood, and journalists play an essential role in building that shared body of knowledge. Today's guest argues that technological change is placing great strain on our democratic societies. He's Llewellyn King this week on Story in the Public Square. And welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. We do that by visiting each week with the best contemporary storytellers, authors, scholars, filmmakers, and journalists, really anyone using or studying narrative to explain the world in which we live. This week, we're joined by Llewellyn King, an accomplished journalist, columnist, and host of White House Chronicle. And Llewellyn, I have to note that Wayne and I wanted to have you on for a lot of reasons, but we also wanted to publicly thank you. When we started this little experiment called Story in the Public Square, you were just a tremendous mentor. You were tremendously generous with your time and with the support of your crew on your set. You gave us 6 episodes to try to learn our way through. You taught us how to do this, so we just wanted to say thank you.
Oh, that's very gracious. Thank you so much. Well, clearly you've done rather better than I have.
I don't believe that.
Polished and accomplished.
Your show's in its 20th year now.
22nd year.
22nd year. How did you get started?
Well, it's interesting in a way. I started it because you were not seeing many journalists. I was in Washington. I had a small newsletter publishing company that I had founded and owned. You saw bylines, but you didn't see the faces. There were only 2 other programs, McLaughlin and PBS's own program.
Grotsky and Company.
No, that was, it was about them, but that had just failed because, Grotsky had died or retired. I can't remember which. But anyway, the idea was unknown journalists would come to the air and we'd talk about the news. Unfortunately, things changed, or fortunately, I don't know. The news changed and television changed. We got the all news channels. And now when you turn on your television, what do you see? Journalists talking about the news. Yeah. It's almost all you see. And you hear the presenters saying things like, now we go to the panel, or the panel will discuss. So journalists talking about the news ceased to be interesting or unique. It became very standard. So we've sort of moved the program along. We now like to look at what affects the way we live that isn't purely political, but has a political dimension to it. For example, technology, which is a very powerful changer of the human setup, and other things like that.
That's something that you've been, some of your recent columns and some of your recent episodes have been looking at. The impact of technology. What in particular are you thinking about?
Well, I'm looking first at changes. The first one you see coming along is smart cities. Beyond that is the fourth industrial revolution. That's what the man who created the European Economic or the World Economic Forum is talking about. It's what they talk about at their annual meeting in Davos, in Switzerland. It is all of this new technology. It's not just computers. It's everything that is going to change everything. And it's going to happen faster. It's beginning, but much faster than we think. It's automated airplanes, automated cars, automated trucks. It's facial identification for everything. Sadly, probably an end to privacy as we've known it. It is the sweeping arrival of artificial intelligence, taking over a lot of the menial tasks or directing machines to do the menial tasks. And we don't know how far it goes. We don't know where the end, but it's a lot to think about. It's a sort of existential threat to the way we have been. We don't know. It seems to me that all automation has been additive in the past. Ned Ludd was wrong when he broke the mills in England. What happened traditionally was we got automation, we got new products, we got new work, we got new productivity. So everything got bigger and better and bigger and better. And the Industrial Revolution produced a situation after a lot of experiment and a lot of cruelty, a situation in the advanced countries where more people live better than they ever have historically, and a remarkable achievement in terms of human happiness, contentment, fulfillment. But artificial intelligence at this point looks as though it's not additive, that it's subtractive, that it will take away jobs, that it will take away things, it will take away privacy, it will take away all sorts of things that we've come to revere. If you, for example, have automated trucks, there are about 3.5 million truck drivers in the US. Well, even if 2 million of them lost their jobs, that is a huge impact, a giant impact. We've seen this happen in a very small scale. When they automated the elevators in New York City, 40,000 elevator operators lost their jobs. And many of them lived in the South Bronx. Now, they were not instrumental in the collapse of the South Bronx, but it was contributory. People who had dignity. They didn't make a lot of money, but they had a lot of dignity. I took Mr. Rockefeller up, or I took G. Wayne Miller up today. People like that. And it was dignified work. It has responsible and dignified. When they were automated, those people fell out of work. And although I hear all the time about retraining, it has its limits. Mm-hmm. Middle-aged people do not retrain easily. And just think about it. What of equal dignity, don't talk about money, talk about dignity. It is one of the key ingredients in human satisfaction. What happens with an elevator operator? What do you retrain them for of equal dignity? I can't think of anything. You can give them a job selling hamburgers, but it is not equal dignity.
So the fourth industrial revolution clearly will affect jobs, including job loss and loss of meaningful work. What about the everyday American? How will her or his life change, you know, from getting up in the morning till going to sleep at night? I mean, clearly there's a whole range of impact here coming and that coming soon.
We don't know. We don't know the speed and we don't know the extent of the change. All we know is the change is coming and it will impact your life. I posit, and that's all, that you will buy an airline ticket on the web, as you probably do now, but it will also take a picture of your face, facial identification. You'll then not have to go through security at the airport. You'll walk right on the airplane where there'll probably be, and this is my imagination at work here, a crew of stewards and stewardesses, but no pilots, because airplanes won't really need pilots. They could fly themselves perfectly well. It's called fly-by-wire in the internals of an airplane, extended outside.
Well, a lot of flying now is done without pilot only sitting in a cockpit and watching the software.
Well, absolutely. What has happened is that flying an airplane has become systems management. They are not flying. Right. I'm a private pilot, or used to be. We fly airplanes. Airline pilots manage systems.
Wow, that's a very good way to put it.
And this is a big change. And this is true in a lot of things. As you get more automation, which is what you're seeing, the automation of an airliner, and incidentally, in absolute use, correct use of fly-by-wire means computers on an aircraft doing what people used to do. And they do it better. Yeah. For example, jet fighters cannot be flown in all conditions by the pilot in the way that we're used to, because it's an inherently unbalanced airplane, needs a computer which can think faster. And you see that everywhere. The new sticks in a lot of airliners are not actually attached to the controls. They're attached to a device that feeds to a computer that moves the controls. These things are happening. Medicine is going to change very profoundly. The individual, you, the patient, the sick person, may lose something, but the amount of diagnosis available will increase geometrically. The amount of identifying a similar situation elsewhere could be somebody who's had this disease in Australia or China. So in that sense, medicine will improve. In the sense of you going there to the doctor, that may not improve. You probably get even less time with the physician.
When you think about, if you think about the international system as inherently competitive, are there some states, some nations that are responding to this fourth industrial revolution better or more aggressively or more successfully than others? And how does the United States rate in that?
Estonia. There are countries that have put a big effort, Estonia is one of them, I believe, into total digital. You're digitized at the time of birth. You get a number, a place in the society. It's all known. And it goes, follows you through your life to your burial, including your education, etc. And many things are done by computers. Does it make it better? I think it makes certain countries competitive, particularly small countries. We don't know what it does to very large countries, because as countries get bigger, they get more untidy. A big country is not a tidy little country like Switzerland, for example, which is highly organized. Big countries are untidy. Part of the joy of America, the absolute incredible joy of this country, is its untidiness. And I don't think that pure efficiency is a desirable goal. Some things should be done efficiently. But do you want to live an efficient life? Do you want to take all of the casualness, the happenstance out of it? That seems to me rather dismal in prospect.
What does the fourth industrial revolution mean for democracy? Looking at a more macro picture here.
Democracy is in trouble without it. We may not get to it. It's very strange. We had democracy looking good and capitalism looking good, and suddenly things have begun to go wrong. Other forces are at work in this country and in Europe, which are the two that we look at in terms of democracy, because these are the places where democracy is most established and where, if it falters, the signal is terrible. We have lost a lot of the values that we gave to politicians or we expected them to abide by. And we have a lot of frustration and unhappiness throughout societies in Western Europe and in the US. And often that frustration produces bizarre people, bizarre things. It swings very far right, or it swings very far left. Britain may swing very far left if the Labour Party and particularly the Labour Party of today wins the next election, which is highly likely. We have swung very far right. Obviously, Poland, Hungary have gone way right. France is in this state. Germany's in this state. We're not sure where it's going to come out. Politicians say they have answers. People are looking for politicians who come out of the West on a white horse or any compass direction you like. It doesn't have to be the West. We're looking for people on horses, and we're not getting them. When they get into office, we've seen it in the US, we saw it in Britain, it's happening in other countries in Europe. There's a great unhappiness. Some of Europe's unhappiness is fed as some of our unhappiness by migration. The people of the earth are moving across it and about it. Huge quantities of people are trying to get into Europe. People in Eastern Europe are trying to get into Western Europe. People in North Africa are trying to get into Europe. And if they had the means, people in Central and Southern Africa would be trying to get into Europe, because those societies are failing. Mm. And you vote with your feet. We tend to think we have an immigration problem in the United States. We have no such thing. We have some people trying to get in from the South. But we don't have an overwhelming, we don't have the equivalent of what Europe has with boats coming across the Mediterranean. And, of course, most immigration takes place by seemingly legal means.
Right.
Get on an aeroplane, go on a vacation, stay. Come on a ship, stay. Jump ship, stay. And we've probably treated this entirely wrongly. I've had a lot of a lot of problem with what our attitude to immigration and the idea that immigrants in an immigrant country are somehow foul and unhuman and despicable. They are people trying to get a better life. The most fundamental of all human desires, a better life.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. Four times every weekend, you can find us on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce this program with a talented team of professionals at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. In my day job, I run the Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy at Salve Regina University in historic Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, I'm at JM Lutis. Joining me as he does every week is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller, who is the author of 17 books and an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. You can connect with Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Llewellyn King, a veteran journalist, columnist, and host of the long-running White House Chronicle. He's on Twitter, too, at Llewellyn King 2, L-L-E-W-E-L-L-Y-N, King, and the number 2. You've written at length about the role of disinformation in European politics. What's the threat, what's the challenge we're facing, and how should democracies respond?
Well, one of the threats to democracy, and they're multiple, incidentally, I think it'll survive. But
that's good news.
One of the threats, I'm not the arbiter of this. The threat in Europe is from Russia. I am part of the Association of European Journalists. My wife and I are the two sort of honorary members, if you will, and we go to their annual congress, which is very enlightening, because these are working journalists, not stars, not big names, people who work at our trade across Europe. And their big problem, the year before last we met in Lithuania, this year was in Greece, next year will be somewhere else. Their big problem is disinformation, fake news that is actually fake news, not what President Trump has called fake news, but where events are stage managed to produce something that is not true. There are, they say, 2,000 to 3,000 people in Moscow just working on this. One of the problems they had was with skinheads, this idea that Europe is attacked by skinheads and right-wing Nazis, etc. In Lithuania, they found that, I think it was Lithuania, it was one of the Baltic countries, which are the most under threat, that the skinheads were in fact Russian agents. So they say, how do we know? When we cover a piece of news, how do we know? We can film it, we can record it, we can write in our notebooks what we saw, but was it true? I don't think we've ever seen disinformation on this scale. Modern technology makes it possible. It's supported with broadcasting, it's supported with the internet, and now with actual fake events. That is what is bothering European journalism. It certainly is feeding into the politics of Europe, and Russia has shown an interest in destabilizing European elections, as it has shown an interest in destabilizing American. Well, there's no concerted counter, because it's a new problem. How do you deal with it? How do you know what is true? When the White House talks about alternative facts, that's bad enough. When alternative facts are contrived by a very large country, Russia, which has an interest. I've been trying to find out what Russia's real interest is, and it appears sort of long traditional destabilize your neighbors. One, they have other ambitions, which unfortunately I fear that we have played to, like getting a warm water port, which they'll get in the Mediterranean as a result of Syria. But we don't have a way of fighting this kind of massive disinformation, where you cannot find out if something is real or unreal, whether it happened or whether it was staged. And it's very threatening to democracy, and it's threatening to the general peace and well-being of people who live in the democracies.
So you have spent your entire adult professional life as a journalist, and you, of course, still are a journalist. What is the future of the industry, both globally and here in America?
We need to stop wringing our hands about newspapers. They are in decline because the old source of revenue has disappeared. Some are getting a new life through the internet. The Washington Post, although it belongs to Jeff Bezos, the richest man in the world, has a new kind of energy through its internet as much as through the newspaper itself. Even the Washington Times, the right-wing paper, which has a very small circulation in Washington, now has a big internet circulation. The Guardian, a British left-wing paper, has a massive American circulation.
Yeah.
This is the future. I think that Politico and Axios are leading the way. Whether they're actually going to make the difference, but the news is going to come over the net. It is not going to come in the newspaper. And unless newspapers change their ways, stop trying to be oracular and put all yesterday's news on the front page, they've got to have what we used to call in the trade second-day stories. You're not going to get there. And what's going to actually happen to the newspaper, we don't know. I'm a renegade. I've discovered that I like reading newspapers on the internet. I prefer looking through them, but actually reading, I find it better on the internet. And that for me is as though I'd committed a crime.
We forgive you.
I am strangling a baby, or not a baby, I'm strangling whatever it was that has given me 60 or so years of fabulous life. Because, as you know, Wayne, there is no better job than being a journalist.
No, I completely agree.
But we're sorry about this, old chap.
My life is full of bad decisions.
You have the second best kind of job. Yeah.
You know, you.
I hope your family's not watching.
Well, no. One of President Trump's favorite stories about building the wall on the southern border is that it will pay for itself. And you wrote a column recently that said, "Well, sure, if you wait a couple of thousand years." What were you saying?
Well, the walls of history, Hadrian's Wall, the wall around China, these things are great tourist attractions nowadays and bring money in right at the time they did not perform as planned. Mm-hmm. I also, in that same article, mentioned ha-has. Ha-ha is where you have a depression in the ground, then a wall, so it's like an infinity pool. You look right across it. It's what we should have if we're going to have a wall. You can see everything that's going on, but when you try to get it, you find you've got a huge 30-foot wall. They're called ha-has, which is really rather sad, because they were favored around lunatic asylums, particularly in Australia. But they were also used to keep animals out of great estates where they didn't want to spoil the view with a wall, so you basically put the wall in a hole. Mm. And it's very effective. And so anyway, I mentioned that. I don't think it's going to happen, but it would deal with the visual problem.
So here we are at the beginning of 2019, and the presidential election of 2020 in the U.S. is already beginning to take some shape. What do you think of the candidates who have announced so far or potentially may announce on both the Democratic and Republican side and independent, and realizing we could do an entire show with that, and we only have about 3.5 minutes left.
Thank you. I think that we have a lot of stars in the sky. I think most of them will burn out, will disappear. But I think it is encouraging to people that they're tired of the old politics and the old politicians. I think, though, that a lot of them need to learn their trade. You know, you can have people like Alexandria Ocasio
Cortez,
yeah. Who is very inspiring. I mean, she's got a lot of chutzpah. She's got a lot of style. But she has to learn the trade. And what we have seen of national politicians is if they didn't do time on the school board, time in the state legislature, they tend to make mistakes. that experienced politicians who have learned the trade do not make. But having said that, I'm all for these new, young, hopeful people because they give hope. And we have had some very young people in history who have done very well. In science, we always look to young people. Apollo 11, everybody in the control room was under 28. Oh, I think that was the average age. But it was just extraordinary. They basically were 25 and 26-year-olds going to the moon. Well, this can work elsewhere. But politics tends to require a little more preparation. Ideally, a candidate for president, I think, should have run a state, not a corporation. Because if they run a corporation, you get what you saw with the Trump people who came in and thought, we bought this, it's ours, we can do what we want with it and trash it if we want to, because we got it, it's ours. We're proprietors. Politicians are not proprietors. Presidents are not proprietor-in-chief. They are our servants, hopefully doing our bidding and doing it well. So I think that I like the young people. I'd like to see more miles on some of them. I think that it will happen. I think they're learning a lot of things. They're learning, for example, as Gillibrand is learning, that what you once said in politics will come back. Mm-hmm. And this is worse all the time. I have found as a journalist, particularly on television, on White House Chronicle, that interviewing politicians doesn't work terribly well anymore because they're scared to talk, because they know it can be retrieved. There are all kinds of that artificial intelligence we talk about. It's very good for retrieving what you said on television 20 years ago or what you wrote in your school yearbook or in your school magazine. The retrieval system has kind of silenced them. I think that's unfortunate. A lot of people change their minds. But young politicians are good. Look at Winston Churchill. There's somebody who annoyed everybody when he came on the scene, made some big mistakes, some big successes, big mistakes. He was not considered a star in 1939. He was considered a pain somewhere. In 1940, he was the man who saved the world. So you've got to learn the trade. You've got to wait for your opportunity. And you don't know when that opportunity will
and we'll
come.
We'll see if the Democrats have a Winston Churchill in the ranks. Llewellyn King, the show is White House Chronicle. Thank you so much for being with us this week. That's all the time we have this week. But if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org, where you can also catch up on previous episodes. He's Wayne, I'm Jim, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.